Attention, all true believers.
Rejoice, fellow listeners and true believers. We have returned. That's right. Your Brain on Comics has pulled itself out of its various dens of iniquity and has come back to give you more reviews, news, and general drivel on the state of the comics industry and various juxtaposed images that are printed on the bodies of dead trees. Otherwise, otherwise known as comics.
And more comics, to be on, than ever.
Yes, yes. That is the Unman, my faithful co-host and faulty co-pilot, and I am the Bent One. I have things to say on comics. We both do.
Them by all means, O Mighty Master, which I don't usually call the Bent One the Mighty Master. It's just occasionally.
Unless it's the Master Ass Blaster, and then and then it's far more accurate. Anyway, so we've got several things we are going to discuss today. We would start off with, you know, talking about what we've read and things that, you know, had been looking forward to, or comics that we had mentioned in previous shows that are about to come out. But we have been gone for a while, so it's time to do a hard reset. I am, of course, as I said, the Bent One, but I am an aspiring comic book artist myself. Many, many long hours of practice are spent each day, drawing and whatnot,
and drooling.
Yes, sometimes drooling on my digital screen as I scribble away. But I will do my best not to plug myself too much, because that's not what this podcast is for. This podcast is for talking about indie comics, talking about mainstream comics, problems,
old comics, new comics,
historical
and fresh as a daisy comics.
Indeed, people you've never heard of, and the greats such as Kirby and I'll let the Unman pipe in for that, because the Unman is the link to the past here in the comics. He has, as we have come to call it, the bucket of infinity, a veritable unlimited amount of digital comics which he can peruse through.
The digital comics collection that Thanos wishes he had.
Oh, indeed. He searches for it even now as he...
Even now
as he looks for his son in the Infinity Gauntlet.
Fortunately, I'm protected by an almost unbreakable screen of mediocrity from his gaze.
Indeed. Yes, we all wish we had a bucket of infinity, but sadly, only the Unman truly has it. Well, that's not true. I have a flash drive which has all of it on it too. So it's not really a unique item in the universe. But yes. So we will later on be talking a little bit about some Thor comics in honor of the new Thor movie that just came out, Thor: The Dark World. There's a bunch of other stuff as well. Of course, just last month, in October 2013, New York Comic Con was held. I only got to go for one day, but I made it count. I met a bunch of people, perused around Artist Alley, and I picked up several very interesting indie comics, things that just kind of jumped out to me, and a few people that I had actually heard of before that I ran into. But to start all this off, the Unman has very interesting views on movies and whatnot that
contrarian, well, negative, well, backwards ass, from the hills, retroactive, and obstructionist.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
proudly so.
This is a man who has not and will never see the Lord of the Rings movies, even though they are widely touted as being some of the more faithful adaptations of books to come.
You know what happened to Saruman when he studied the arts of the enemy too deeply.
Indeed. But I'm not quite sure what your views are on, you know, the Marvel movies, because obviously they're not supposed to be direct adaptations of the comics. They are, you know, Marvel has their hand in it, and they're kind of making their own cinematic universe.
In fact, I'm all for it. I think it's... The comics have always been a sort of a bastard form, right? They've been printed on the backs of ads and newspapers starting a century ago or so. They've freely contradicted and revised themselves. They've they've had to opportunistically worm their way forward through the economy year by year, decade by decade, generation by generation, keep making money so they could keep on existing. And this is just a kind of in that tradition, the kind of the artistic opportunism of comics is part of their kind of mad, chaotic glory. So although I'm not myself a fan of the, a goer and a fan of the movies, they don't offend me in any way. They seem like all part of the tradition.
Mm-hmm. Of course, other fans of the comic book movies will know that there were a little bit of fits and starts when Hollywood first kind of turned their attention toward it with like the Spider-Man movies, which are the first one is somewhat enjoyable, but the whole idea of what the comic book movie really was still being played around with, and they were full of really bad kind of one-liners, especially in the Spider-Mans, and then there was also the Daredevil movie that was made, and the X-Men movies, which actually the X-Men movies have kind of still been their own thing, and they've continued onward. But the main interest here is that Marvel they own a lot of the licenses to most of their characters, which include hardback, written word publications or movies or TV. But Sony had picked up several licenses, including Spider-Man and Daredevil and Ghost Rider and I believe a few others. And only recently did some of those licenses go back over to Marvel. Of course, Sony held on to Spider-Man and they rebooted it, and they're doing a very good job with those movies. But the Daredevil license went back to Marvel, and a lot of people were wondering for a long time where that's going to come in, because Marvel only recently started going into the world of TV. They now have the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. TV show, which it's not quite as high of an art form as something like, Mad Men, but it's a lot of fun. It is a Joss Whedon child, so it's got a lot of, great dialogue, a lot of quirky humor in it, some little tiebacks to Firefly.
Right, it was fun to see the minister got dude from Firefly showing up as a doctor at S.H.I.E.L.D.
Back to Marvel TV talk. What I was saying before we were so rudely interrupted by what I believe to be a malicious force such as Skynet that exists on the internet. The license for Daredevil was recently reacquired by Marvel, and a lot of the fans were very interested to know what they were going to do with it, because the Daredevil movie is not bad, but it's from that, I guess you could almost call it the Silver Age era of comic book movies, to put that into perspective, where, before Marvel kind of started setting the standard for, what the movies really were going to be, or what the tone was going to be, just enough comedy, but, still lots of really good action and good storytelling. Those early movies were either very kind of paint by numbers, or they were way too jokey. Marvel recently, there was a press release that Marvel and Netflix are teaming up to do a four-part TV series, which is going to be available through Netflix. It's going to, all the episodes are going to air on Netflix. They're not going to go to regular TV. But it's going to include all of the kind of the working class heroes from New York, which is they specifically said Iron Fist, Luke Cage, Daredevil, and Jessica Jones. I have to admit, I'm not completely familiar with the Jessica Jones character, but I will
certainly...
I will certainly brush up. I know she appears in, I believe she plays a bigger part in, a lot of those hero storylines, specifically Luke Cage, or as he later came to call himself, Power Man.
Well, they basically they needed a babe in the lineup, and there's a
of course
notable shortage of babes in the superheroes lineup, so
mm-hmm.
they're going to reach for someone a little less famous because that's what there is.
True. Of course, there's still people going on about, like, oh, well, we really need to get some more representation in there. Like, I personally think that if they did either a TV series or a movie for Ms. Marvel, that would be quite excellent.
Or they could do certainly a Black Widow is a character that could be
oh, yes.
for a movie or, yeah, a lot of promise there.
Well, going back to the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. TV show, I think that would be fantastic if they could include that character in there somehow. But of course, that's part of the S.H.I.E.L.D. cinematic universe. So the actress tied to the Black Widow is Scarlett Johansson, and so as far as I know, they've only had one cameo, a big name cameo on the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. TV show, which was Samuel L. Jackson, who plays Nick Fury, and he appeared in kind of an after scene, you know, special little scene that Marvel kind of specializes in. But I don't think they'll bring her in just because they've already kind of they've established her in the movies, which is slightly a shame. But I guess that's why they're kind of capitalizing on you know, this whole set of heroes. But going back to the press release, they essentially said that they're going to run these series and over a period of a few years, and then it will end up with them doing a mini series, which will be called The Defenders, because in the comics, those characters, they formed their own little team that operates out of Hell's Kitchen in New York, and they're called The Defenders. So I think it'll be very interesting to see how they kind of will, you know, interweave the shows and work on developing those characters, and certainly seeing which, you know, which actors they decide to go for these characters, because since it'll be TV, you know, they'll have to get possibly unknown actors or, you know, existing TV stars, but certainly none of the movie stars will be in these. So it'll be very interesting to see how they go about it, because it's a much different style of storytelling than they've been going for with the Marvel movies. High action plots and areas of storyline with that, such as the new Captain America movie that's going to be coming out, which they're focusing on the Winter Soldier. I won't give away too much about that. If you know your comics history, you will know everything about the Winter Soldier and who he is and the whole backstory behind that. But for anyone who is just beginning to take an interest in comics because of the movies, you are in for a treat. That's all I have to say. But yeah, with all these TV shows coming out and the movies, and there's rumors that Doctor Strange is going to be included in the Marvel Cinematic Universe lineup.
It's bloody high time. I mean, he's one of their great intriguing properties. You know,
he's been largely ignored in the you know, outside of his own comic, which I think is, like you said, it's rather unsettling. I think there's so many interesting things they could do with Doctor Strange. It really is a shame we have not seen more of him. But then again, he kind of exists in his own little world that's separate from most of the Marvel universe, with all the mystic. He is the master of the mystic arts, the sorcerer supreme, as it were. So we will talk a bit more about the Marvel movies, specifically the new Thor movie, later on. But what we would like to do now is go a bit more into the source of these movies, the actual comics. I know the Unman, he has been reading a lot of stuff on his iPad over there. And so why don't you fill us in a little bit? What are some things you have been reading recently?
Well, I've been reading all across the complex, and basically Thor was born the year I was born. 1962 was the first appearance of Thor in Journey into Mystery number 83, plotted by Stanley, scripted by his brother Larry, which is my actual first name, coincidentally, and it's penciled by Jack Kirby. Jack Kirby was not the only person to pencil Thor. For a while, there were other people, including, you know, Don Heck, Joe Sinnott, and a couple others, I believe. But he settled down as the Thor artist, and I think did about 100 issues, 100 classic issues of Journey into Mystery, which became The Mighty Thor. And, of course, there's been a plethora of Thor titles in the last decade or two. Many of them superb. I think some of Marvel's best stuff. And most recently, the ongoing series is Thor, God of Thunder, which is, I think, up to issue number 13 or 14 right now, and that began in 2012. So, in the spirit of the Unman's deathless curiosity about comics, old and new, I've been reading my way through the first half dozen or so issues of Thor, God of Thunder, which the Bent One has also commenced looking into.
Yes. I haven't gotten through.
Comments on your side so far?
Yes, I've only gotten through the first two issues, and I have to say the art is truly something to behold. It's, from what I can tell, there's a few panels that look almost like they've, you know, there's some sort of a emulation of like a classical art that's going on, which I approve of highly. There's really kind of, it's a, the coloring is a very kind of like a soft feel to it. It's not, you know, the hard kind of, you know, I guess, you know, the garish gradients that you see in a lot of, you know, the other big Marvel titles. And it really has a definitely a different feel from normal comic art. A bit more realistic in terms of the expressions and, you know, the surroundings. But it does have some really nice kind of classic designs to it, at least for the villain. I won't give away too much of that, because if you do want to start reading this, it definitely is. I would say it's definitely worth reading. It's got a lot of neat hooks to it. It's funny I say hooks, because the general plot so far is that it's following Thor throughout different ages of his life. Early, before he inherited the hammer, or before he became worthy, then present day, and then far into the future. A very grim, dark future, as we've seen in so many comics. But there is something that is preying on the gods, referred to by a specific name later on, which is mentioned in the first issue, but is known mostly just as the God Butcher. From what I can see, there's going to be more interactions between Thor and this creature. At least in issue one, he sees some of its handiwork, and then millennia later, which is the present day, he comes across some more of its grisly leavings, and he has a vague memory of what it was, and then they go to him later on, and he's fighting hordes of these creatures that are in league with it. But one thing I would say, maybe that was jumped the gun a little bit, was in issue two, the creature is shown fully and completely in a battle with Thor, and with the amount of build-up I guess they were giving in issue one, I kind of expected to not maybe see it for another four or five issues. But
yes, I noticed the first frame in issue two, where the God Butcher creature is seen, there's a rather, to me, kind of somewhat annoying shot of this kind of black spatula that he wears over his ass crack.
Yes.
Like, this costume is just a little bit annoying to me. Somehow, ass crack emphasizing costumes are just not high on my list of favorite things. You know, if I was to sing the song about my favorite things, it wouldn't be in that song.
The first shot that I saw of him, I thought, well, he looks a bit like the Spectre. But then, of course, going further in, that does quickly dispelled. He does have a very
design DNA there.
Right. He's got the Voldemort nose,
or lack thereof. Lack of nose.
Yes.
This artist has a thing for, I think, noseless aliens.
Right. The Star Trek aliens that have had their features kind of brushed out. But aside from the fact that the villain essentially is wearing a black thong. He is. It's a magical black thong. No slippage, no wardrobe malfunctions. But he is a quite a terrifying villain in terms of his actions. So, yes, laugh all you like at his strange gravity-defying black thong, but he will kill and destroy anything. Specifically gods. He's essentially a god serial killer.
He's essentially a sort of a neo-atheist. He's kind of a Richard Dawkins with superpowers. You know, he's got a thing against gods, and of course that does get explained later on in the series. And he dislikes them very much, you see, which is why he butchers them. It's an intriguing series. It's very dark. It's very it's got a lot of disturbing violence in it. I mean, I don't necessarily object to that. The art and writing are great. I'm not entirely satisfied. I guess I feel that they've taken it to such a kind of weird extreme of violence. I mean, it's not every day you get to see an emaciated Volstagg nailed to a cross. This is one of the things we're treated to.
I don't necessarily think I'd like to see that, but I guess if I keep reading, I will.
I'm not sure I did like seeing it. The question is, you know, why? What's going on here? And of course, since at the very beginning,
Stan Lee wasn't worried about, what do I mean by a god? What is a god? What am I doing here making a comic book about a god? What does that mean? He's just like, oh, I'm going to put some horns on this guy's helmet or whatever, wings, and steal this character, you know, flip through some paperback books on Norse mythology. And in fact, there's a quote, if you look up the Wikipedia on Thor, there's a great quote from Stan Lee, how he says, well, we'd invented the Hulk, and how do you make a character more powerful than the Hulk? Well, you make him and you make a god. So I thought, well, we've done Greek and Roman, how about something from Norse mythology? So there was no, of course, and quite rightly, there was no deep thought. But, you know, now, you know, a lifetime later, they're still working with Thor, and now there's a plethora of gods. In this series, gods become a sort of almost a commonplace. There's this untold numbers of sort of pantheons through the universe, most of which don't have noses, and they're all completely vulnerable to this God Butcher character. They seem to, the question arises, what are these things? They seem to be sort of a commonplace species of, how do I put this, a kind of alien almost. They're kind of long-lived and powerful, but they seem to have kind of localized influence or be associated with individual planets. Where do they come from? These questions kind of arise. Really, they're kind of comic book theology questions. Like, What are you talking about with these gods? In this series, I think that they're kind of cheapening down some of the kind of the wonder and the glory charge that for a while the older Thor comics exploited so successfully with regard to Asgard. You know, and by just multiplying the number of these, kind of making the gods kind of a trivial, commonplace thing, almost like a kind of cosmic vermin. At least that's how the God Butcher sees and treats them. Not putting down that, I mean, the writing is great, the art is great. It's well worth looking into. But again, there's some bigger issues with it.
Yes. Yeah, you will have to do quite a bit of reading in the comic. Unlike some other comics where they, you know, they rely more on the dialogue between the characters to kind of build the story. I'm thinking mainly of X-Men, just because where they have so many characters, they can't, you know, they don't have the luxury of going on, you know, lengthy internal dialogues. But in this comic, it really is, it's just focusing on Thor. And yes, there are some Vikings who accompany him, and, you know, he's off on some other planet talking to some aliens, but a decent amount of it is internal monologues from him. So you will have to do a fair bit of kind of reading to get the story. I am guilty of flipping through. When I first get a comic, I flip through it and kind of try to get the story just through the art, which is the hallmark of a really good comic. If you can flip through it and you can tell exactly what's going on without having to read any of the words, you've got a good comic. This is still a good comic, but in a slightly different brand, where you really do have to read and pay attention to figure out what's going on. Of course, you know, it's still pretty obvious that, well, at least with the second comic, you know, Thor is in this, you know, multi-page battle with this this dark being. Even though there is, you know, far more emphasis on the actual written word in this comic, it does not detract from it. Like I said, the art is fantastic. The story is well written. But yes, I will definitely be continuing to read this, if only because each issue is going to have elements from his very early years, the present day, and then the future. So you're getting a little bit of a teaser as to what's down the road for Thor, but only getting a little bit of information in each storyline as you go on.
Yes, the structure is a complex chain of hooks, sort of like those little plastic monkeys, you know, that when you're a kid, you pick up one monkey with the next one. Well, ideally, you do want, the course, you want the interest of the thing to chain along when you're doing a multi-part story like this. I like multi-part stories. I mean, back in the 60s, there was this big thing at Marvel. They 60s and 70s, they, you know, people would kind of rage back and forth, you know, no, I want single-issue stories. No, I want multiple-issue stories. Because they both have their virtues, and it is possible to do great stories both ways. There was, for a while, I think, in Thor, it might have been that they ruled out multi-issue stories. They said, no, we're going to do single-issue stories for it, which, was, of course, was crippling, because it's just too narrow a frame to always be stuck with.
Right. I distinctly remember a specific issue I remember reading, which was Thor and some of his companions. They happened upon this another warrior upon a road somewhere, and his power was based on every time he was thrown down to the earth, he would rise back up with more power, and he drew power from the earth. And eventually Thor realized, oh, well, I'll just shoot him off into the sky, and that was how they solved it. But it was a very simple storyline, and it was contained within one issue.
Yes, so it would be a good exercise maybe for some of the contemporary writers and artists to occasionally have to do a single issue story like that, to kind of make the elegant turns that tightly. Figure skating kind of elegance that's necessary to create a single issue comic. Mm-hmm. And I think we're a little bit afflicted now, both say in television and in comics, with very long, elaborate, somewhat self-important story arcs.
I thought
Battlestar Galactica would be a classic, you know, kind of hold this up in the classroom kind of example of something that ruined itself by... And Thor, too, I think, well, you know, maybe there's a little... Maybe you could have a little more happen in each issue. Maybe you could go a little faster. Maybe it doesn't have to be quite such a cosmic arc.
Well,
I shouldn't have to wait a whole year to find out what happens, that kind of thing. Maybe childish concerns, but hey, you know?
Hey, it keeps you reading. But, I mean, well... going back to some of the early Thor comics, you know, some of those storylines are still the best, even if they are the multi-storylines. Specifically, the one I'm thinking of is where Odin banishes Thor. I cannot remember the reason in the comic, but he is banished to Earth to live as a mortal, and you know, he does not have access to his hammer or his powers. He is still fantastically strong, but for a long period of time, he is without the aid of Mjolnir, which of course they took that storyline, and that was the basis for the first Thor movie that they did, and it worked out very well because it was Thor's journey to become worthy of being Thor and to possess the hammer. Even though he possesses it earlier in the movie, Odin quickly realizes that he is not worthy of the hammer, and he imposes that rule onto the hammer that whoever is worthy. If you are familiar with your comic history, there have been others who have been worthy of the power and who have wielded Mjolnir for a brief amounts of time.
Beta Ray Bill, of course. I'm getting that name right.
Well,
the head like a horse skull.
Yes, he actually has a separate hammer that was made for him by the dwarven smiths of cannot remember the name of that realm. But briefly he did wield the hammer. And then there was some sort of deal worked out between him and Thor and Odin where he was given his own hammer. So, and he's off having cosmic adventures somewhere else. I think Marvel generally does not go back to him very often for stories.
I think he did reappear recently, but he's not, not a major character.
You are right. I did see something about him.
He dated Sif briefly, if we may use such language of the gods. What's interesting about that thing, you recalling this thing about Thor being stripped of his powers, is something that's so basic to superhero comics, comics that are about extraordinary power, which is that all these comics draw their strength from some kind of dance between vulnerability and power. Kryptonite, Superman, Spider-Man, bad social life in high school. All these things, you have to have weaknesses interacting with power. The power is never enough. It's a bore. It's an absolute bore to just have big power smash slightly less big power. There's always this, which at least since the beginning of, well, since the beginning really, since Superman first developed weaknesses back in the 40s, I think Kryptonite first appeared in the early 40s. It's sort of the heart and soul of the superhero genre at its best, is this is the million and one ways you can get some kind of vulnerability to interact with the strength, to challenge it, to undermine it, to create the unexpected, to create drama. Because there's no drama with just a giant fist smashing something that it can smash.
Indeed. Because of that, in some comics, especially I think the Hulk comics, that is a bit harder because the Hulk is always about brute force, and so they've had to add other things like the World War Hulk storyline, which is very, very good. I would suggest anyone who has not read World War Hulk to check that out, which is essentially the Hulk applied to the Spartacus story of Spartacus freeing the slaves. It's very good. It's in space with an axe and all
Hulk
sorts
in
of
space
with an axe. That's a really fun one. But going back to what I was saying, like this new Thor comic, Thor is a god and he's got this fantastic power. His villain, well, he's someone who goes after gods, and his power specifically to hurt gods. So it really kind of is hearkening back to the old style of comic book writing. Like, okay, there's not some sort of like a dark conspiracy between superheroes or like the Civil War where everyone is at their throats and it's very complex story writing and the message gets lost. It's just, okay, Thor's a god. This guy kills gods. They fight. I'm in. It's fun. It's good. Well, yeah. Yes, this story is still dark, but those types of stories are always fun. They're great to read. There's always a lot of intrigue because eventually you know that the hero is going to find some way of defeating or, you know, sealing away the villain. You know, it's the journey to find that. It's not, oh, well, where is this story going? What could possibly happen next? You know what is going to happen. It's just a matter of how it happens. And it's just good old-fashioned storytelling, and it's not going away anytime soon, and this is proof.
Yeah, and Thor has always had, has always been one reason we still have this character after 51 years is that he has a range of dramatically intriguing weaknesses. For instance, in the early years, his love for the human Jane Foster, which pissed his dad off so much.
I think that was one of the reasons why he was...
Thor was again and again stripped of power at various inopportune moments, stranded on Earth. And of course, Odin himself, although often referred to strangely as the all-powerful and all-knowing, just seems not to actually be omnipotent or omniscient. Mm-hmm. They themselves have faced the vague threat of Ragnarok. You know, Thor is actually a very finite god. He's got a kind of willful and pissy dad who is, of course, can do anything he wants with him. He's got heart. He's got, you know, lover issues. You know, he's got issues of the heart that no swinging power hammer can solve. So there's this, you know, and he always wants to do right, and he can't always do right. So there's kind of moral vulnerabilities. He's got love issues. He's got Odin to deal with. So he's had this, you know, and these things have been exploited again and again. His care for Earth, in many interesting ways, which is why we still have Thor titles being issued today, harking all the way back to, of course, 1962 and Stan Lee's idea to make a character more powerful than the Hulk. He ended up, I think, making a character more interesting than the Hulk.
Oh, yes. Like I was saying, there's other characters who have been throughout the years worthy of wielding the hammer. Of course, Thor.
For instance.
Well, yeah. Of course, that only resulted in a dislocated arm and a broken back. But there we go.
I was worthy, but I wasn't strong enough. So indeed, it was a bad scene.
Yes, of course, famously, the Hulk has tried to lift it and failed, even though he is the strongest hero. If I remember correctly, and this is. This is something I would love to see them play around with in the movies, which conceivably they could, would be only a few other heroes have been worthy, and those include Captain America and, I believe, The Thing, of course, Ben Grimm from the Fantastic Four, briefly at one point, which is contradicted later on very bizarrely at the beginning of the Civil War timeline. But specifically, I'm thinking because they've got Captain America in their wheelhouse, that they might eventually... they might eventually play around with that. That could make for some very interesting cinematic action.
And since you bring in Captain America, this sort of opens up the field to other comics. You know,
maybe
move on to.
Oh yes, indeed.
What else is going on? Because you know, Thor.
Well,
say something.
Yes, to transition, I do have one thing I picked up. This is not any of the indie comics I'll be talking about in a moment.
Yeah.
But as you said, Jack Kirby was he was the artist for Thor for a long, long time, like over 100 issues. But if you're not familiar with Jack Kirby, shame on you if you call yourself a comics fan. If not, well, let's get some learning in. Jack Kirby essentially was, when he was still working at Marvel, he was drawing pretty much all of the heroes. And he helped create the look of all of most of those heroes with Stan Lee, and I think there was someone else who may have had some input on those, but for the most part it was Stan Lee and Jack Kirby, and there's been some insinuation in recent years that Stan Lee may have taken more credit for some of the characters from Jack Kirby, but it really boils down to Jack Kirby was an absolute comics machine. He was drawing Fantastic Four, Daredevil, the Hulk, Thor,
Avengers.
But yes, Jack Kirby was drawing so many of these things. And then he went on, of course, to work for DC for several years. But I picked up this book, which is OMAC, the One-Man Army Corps. Yes, Jack Kirby's OMAC. And it was only a 9-issue run. It was ended. It was originally going to be a 10th issue, but for some reason Kirby could not do it, so it ends extremely abruptly, which is quite annoying. But it's based on an idea he had, which was, in the future, we will still need a character like Captain America, and he actually had planned to do a series of stories where Captain America was, frozen again, or he was somehow put into suspended animation again and then emerged again in the future. But he decided, no, I'm not going to do that. It's just a little bit too much. It's too much. So he reinvented it as this character OMAC, which was published at DC.
Oh, yes, the acronym supposed to stand for One Man Army Corps.
Yes, which does work. But as with a lot of old comics, it does feel slightly forced, but it still works. It's kind of one of those things you expect from comics. Like, yes, he is the One Man Army Corps. And there's a great line in here after he first transforms. Let me see if I can find it. Where he's been activated by the Brother Eye satellite to take out this this company that he had the character who is him had worked for.
Just put this in sort of his comics history context. About what years was this coming out?
Oh, let me see. It is in here somewhere. Yes, here's the line. Right after he transforms, says, "My body is rejecting the bullets. I am OMAC." it's so great. But it's if you want to have kind of an introduction to the old comics. Yes, all the old Marvel stuff is good. But this is also it's special in the fact that Kirby wrote it, drew it, edited it, and he did not ink it, of course, but he essentially created the entire thing. The writing is a little bit more simplistic than some of the early Marvel stuff, because obviously Stan Lee was the mastermind behind that. It's a lot of good comics. It's good old-fashioned comics fun, and I would advise anyone to check it out.
As with reading or encountering a lot of culture from the past, whether in music, comics, writing, you have to be willing to tweak your knobs on your receiving set of the mind, maybe I have to let go of a certain kind of seriousness, or maybe I have to accept a certain kind of lightness or folly or a certain kind of seriousness that we're not used to. Right. There are certain limitations that were observed in those comics that seem almost strange to us now, in this extremely post-comics code era where we live now.
Indeed.
If one has to do a certain kind of opening up, except to really get the juice out of all these earlier decades of riches, whether in comics or anything else, really.
Right. Well, that's actually a very good segue into some of the other comics that I picked up at New York Comic Con. Like you said, and there's a certain darkness that's kind of invaded comics, and to really find a lot of that early levity and kind of the shine that comics is kind of lost in terms of the innocence of the storytelling, that is coming back in some ways, but mostly from some of the indie creators. One of the series I picked up, it's a new series from Image, is called Rocket Girl, and it's by
Rocket
Girl. Yes. The story is by Brandon Montclair, and the art is by Amy Reeder, and it's very nice stylized art, very clean, very clean colors, and it really is a very old style story where these scientists are experimenting with some sort of new power source, and this teenage girl appears all of a sudden, claiming to be a policeman from the future, I am a detective from the New York Teen Police Department from 2013. But it takes place back in the 80s. She goes back to prevent some sort of corporation who has been screwing around with time travel to make their company more successful, which of course is violating all sorts of ethics. So she must go back and bring justice. When she comes back immediately, she's got technological problems. You know, she's just kind of operating under the assumption that, okay, well, I still have a job to do. But of course, the police don't know who she is. They're trying to take her in, even though she is the police. But she's highly trained, highly capable. And one of the nice things, oh yes, yes. One of the nice things about this is there's not quite as much of the super sexualized female comic comic character stylings that you see in other comics.
Yeah, mainly because
she is supposed to be a teenage girl, so they can't do too much without it getting weird. But
the 3D Tootsie Roll nipples that come out and poke you in the eye. Christ. I mean, God, the art has become so exaggerated sometimes.
It gets bizarre.
This is very restrained and humanistic, mm-hmm. in its own way, you know.
I knew very little about the comic other than it was, you know, it's not a super kind of crazy dark, you know, comic where all hope is lost. It's just, you know, it's going back to these very simple concepts. She's a teen police officer with a rocket pack from the future, and she's come back to stop crime. That's the comic, and that's where it's going. Of course, then you've got the time traveler aspects where she's, you know, from a year in the future. She's from the future, and now she's living back in the 80s. So I can only imagine there's going to be all sorts of great tie-ins to stuff from the 80s. But
maybe they can mix in some politics, and she can correct some of the crimes of Ronald Reagan while she's back there.
I wouldn't be surprised if they've got some stuff like that. But yeah, so we moving on, because we are...
we're always moving on.
Moving on. Well, keeping with the theme of tying back to the comics of yesteryear, I'm holding two comics in my hand simultaneously. An original copy of Commandy, The Last Boy on Earth, number 15, long time ago. This was, of course, one of the comics from DC that Kirby was working on. A little fact that I forgot to mention earlier. When Kirby was working at DC, he had an obligation to draw, other than what he already did, he had an obligation to do 15 pages a week. And if you think about that, the standard pace for doing comics now is one 22-page issue a month. So he was doing 15 pages every single week, and there was even, according to the intro for OMAC, he said sometimes he did up to 17 pages, and there was one time he did 20 pages in a week. That is absolutely insane. There's no one who can do that anymore and produce the same level of quality, as far as I know.
A single drawing board in his home. I think he used the same drawing board for most of his career, right in his house, and he just sat there and.
There's a great
cigars,
picture.
Very unwise.
There's a great picture here.
Like a nut, and he's really a unique figure in terms of his innovativeness, his the vividness of his action sequences. Sometimes truly, really awesome stuff, and just how loved he is. A uniquely loved figure in comics, and he earned it pencil stroke by pencil stroke.
Oh, indeed. And if you really want to show your love for Kirby, you know, of course, Stan Lee is still alive and kicking and gets the adoration of millions of fans. But of course, Kirby is no longer with us. But there is a Kirby Museum that you can go and donate to online. I actually have a little sticker on my computer, which is his original signature reproduced. And I've got a giant uncolored poster of one of the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Covers, which is featuring Nick Fury with a rocket pack. Getting back to what I was talking about, bringing themes from the old comics into the new comics and just showing how potent they are and how good these original stories were. Like I said, I've got a copy here that I actually just found in my collection of comics. I don't know where I got it, but it is an original copy of Commandy, The Last Boy on Earth.
March 1974.
That, indeed. Yes, issue number 15, where the apes have captured Commandy's his sidekicks or his fellow travelers, and they're strung up in Washington D.C. Oh yes,
apes the remains
in,
of
oh,
Washington.
Yes, it says apes in control of Washington D.C. What will they do with the Watergate secrets?
Yes, I like the time with
it's great.
The Watergate
it's,
time was bizarre, but
really is strange.
Had a kind of madcap fantasticalness in some of these plots. So he was writing as well as drawing these comics. By the mm-hmm. way, he wasn't just drawing all those pages every week. He was
right,
writing
right.
these comics.
Indeed,
scripting
yeah.
them.
But yes, so his influence, of course, stretches onward, but not just through the characters he created, through people being inspired by the old stories. One of the other comics I picked up, I was walking along, and I saw they have these big banners behind the tables, if you've ever been to Comic-Con, and I saw one that had, it was fantastic art, and it had this kind of quirky logo that just says, "The Only Living Boy," and I looked at it, and I thought, wow, that really reminds me of Commandy, and I picked it up and I was flipping through it, and it's very clear that it was inspired by Commandy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a comic I think you could give to a younger, a young boy, you know, maybe around 8 or 9, and he would absolutely love it. It is the story of a young boy who runs away from home and then wakes up in this new and fantastic world that's full of, you know, crazy science and beast men and magic and insect princesses and all sorts of stuff. And he is the only living boy.
It's a lot like the transition from grade school to middle school.
Indeed, indeed. All of a sudden you find these strange hairy creatures roaming
beasts
about who are constantly trying to attack you.
And just forces utterly beyond your control. You're really, a lot of us feel like the last boy on Earth or girl on Earth when we transition into the world where everyone's bigger than we are.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one of the deep kind of psychological appeals of comics.
Right. Yes. He wakes up with no memory of his previous life, and only a stuffed teddy bear backpack, and that's it. But he is a rather tenacious lad, and it does not faze him that he can't remember anything. He immediately meets up with these kind of grotesque goblin like creatures that are hunting him and. This green elf-like creature who comes and rescues him, and of course they are captured and taken to this prison where more of the nefarious villains of the world are revealed. But it does end with a cliffhanger. They are going to do an issue 2, and one of the reasons I would say pick this up is just for the art. The art is it's not quite at the super professional level that you see it from DC or Marvel, but it really is fantastic. It's solid. There's the guy who does this. Let's see. I have it written down. Yes. David Gallagher does the story, and Steve Ellis does the art. They're both co-creators on this. It really is interesting. You can go to it's the only living boy. It's with hyphens in between each word. TheOnlyLivingBoy.com. Actually, in January they're going to be coming out with issue 2. I would say definitely pick it up because it's going back to that kind of simple storytelling, but with amazing kind of modern art, great coloring.
Yeah, I'm liking the cover here. Just pulling that up online. Mm-hmm. Sort of a cartoony style sometimes, but yeah, kind of old school, but new style.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that was one of the things that drew me to it because it is an indie comic, you very rarely see good art in some of the indie comics because. If you are trying to get into doing indie comics, you do have to get an artist if you're just a writer, and it does cost money to hire an artist. And I mean, I'm actually doing a freelance, a 9-page comic, and I already had to, just to make it, worthwhile for the person, I had to bump the rates down quite a bit. But if you are trying to make a comic, it can cost a professional usually ask for around $150 per page for doing the penciling, and the penciling is where it all starts for the art. Moving on from that, yes. Speaking of art that is good in indie comics, I was walking by one of the tables and I saw another comic which has a great title. It's called First Law of Mad Science. And from the cover, I looked at the cover. The cover has some decent art on it, but the overall kind of composition of it does seem a little bit amateurish. And I looked at it and was like, oh, well, it probably is not going to be that good. And I opened it up and I was immediately blown away. The art is, it's like I said before with some of these other indie comics, it's not at super professional level, but the artist is clearly very skilled. There's great poses for the characters. very unique character designs. This particular has all sorts of like industrial drawings in the background of these giant buildings and labs and underground excavations to try to find ancient cities. And there's also kind of some crazy monsters in here. The general premise is that this scientist, he's world famous. He's created many inventions that have improved the world, including a transportation system. But his latest invention are these things called cyber eyes, which are, you know, they are what they sound like. They're cybernetic eyes. They get implanted, and you can see for amazing distances. They can record information. They can give data readout, all sorts of stuff. But people, starting with his son, actually, start to notice that they are seeing these strange kind of slug-like creatures everywhere. But only people with the cyber eyes can see them, and a very small percentage. But it's growing in percentage. So, and it's a big problem. But so when there's an example where his dad and the boy and his father, the scientist, are in the same room, and the boy is looking directly at these creatures which are on his desk. Both of them have cyber eyes. Only the boy can see them, his father can't. But when he downloads the information into the computer and plays it back, it's recorded. So his father can see the creatures on the recording. So it's very clear that they are there. And of course, this presents a big problem. I picked up issues 1 and 2, and the second one focuses more on this other team that was hinted at, shown earlier in the first comic, that are exploring this underground city. You know, there's some very mysterious and creepy things going on. A creature is unearthed, and some sort of mysterious spy is sneaking around in the compound. This is another comic that's got a lot of reading you have to do. There's a lot of dialogue. There is a little bit of an excess of profanity in it. Oh yeah, sorry, I completely forgot to mention the creators. Mike Weinsberg and Oliver Mertz do the story, and then yes, a guy named
Huzzah for the creators.
Indeed, and Daniel Lampham, Lapham, does the art, and it's very good art. It is all in black and white, but it's all done with grayscale. It's still enjoyable to read, They've produced an interesting yarn, and I wish I had bought more of the issues, because now I have to go and find issue 3. It's very, very riveting. It's also kind of focusing on inspiration from the older stuff, which is this explorer family where there's the young boy, the father, then there's the mother's there, and then there's a creation of the father, which is a robot girl. Who appears to have, full sentience and everything. So she is part of the family as well. But I can only imagine they will get more and more embroiled in this story of this underground city that's been created, and the mystery of the creatures that only certain people can see with the cyber eyes. Find it, buy it, and read it. You will like it. Well, I have one final thing I want to mention, and then we'll probably wrap up here.
Wrap it up in stretchy plastic, which will be very exciting.
Yeah, wrap it up in little Stretch Armstrong hands. I've got these comics created by illustrator Paul Hope, Hoppe, and they are called Journey into Misery, which of course is a play on the original Journey into Mystery comics, and they're tiny books. They're which are called ash cans in the comic book industry, where you print off, it's black and white. There's no coloring done, and these are all traditionally done, pen and ink. The lettering is hand done, and these are all essentially satires on those original comics. All the characters are, the world that is shown through these comics is like that old style of superhero world. There's teams that are very clearly making fun of the Avengers and some of the other superhero teams. But the two main characters are this woman who is the CEO of this company, and just a random office worker who she's about to fire, or she fires, and he's about to kill himself.
There aren't enough random office workers in comics. I just wanted to put that out.
Yes, but what of the story of the grunts in the comics? But anyway, so right as they're about to have a confrontation, He's literally about to kill himself. Aliens all of a sudden invade and take them up to their spaceship and perform experiments and give them superpowers, because that's a good idea. And then, of course, they escape, and the woman is this, she's a, you know, kind of this high-powered CEO character, and she takes no shit from anyone. And the other, the guy is a very kind of meek, he does have some spine to him, but he's kind of like just overwhelmed by the situation. He has his abilities are slight invulnerability and the ability to turn invisible, and her abilities are that she's super strong, invulnerable, and she can flame on like the torch. But of course, there's all sorts of, you know, funny stuff that he's put in. The best way to describe these comics is that I cannot remember where this term comes from, but there's lots of sex and larfs. there's constant nudity in this. Lots of kind of pseudo-sexual themes, but not for the sake of, you know, kind of like pornography, just to kind of add hilarity to the story. So the guy, when he ever uses his invisibility, it turns him invisible, but nothing else. So he has to strip down if he wants to actually use it. And of course, the woman, when she activates her flame power, it burns up everything. So she has to fly around
unstable
naked.
Unstable molecular clothing.
Oh, of course not. Of course not. But there's another story in one of the issues. There's five little these mini issues. One of them, they have to go into some sort of other dimension to fight this time organization, and the portal is a swimming pool, but they can't take any inorganic matter with them, so they have to jump through naked. It's just a lot of like bizarre humor, and you can read these
just an ordinary daily life, you know.
Mm-hmm. Oh yes, there's
a
little
doctor for colonoscopy. You know the comic would have most of us getting naked.
Oh, God.
But otherwise, it just doesn't happen that often in these contexts.
Yes, yes. There is a little tagline up in these comics that say suggested for very immature mature readers. So
I like it. I like it.
It's great. It's great. As far as I know, I don't know if you can buy these online. There is a website for this artist. Let's see. Oh yeah, it's a comicbeholder.blogspot.com. And I'm, like I said, I'm not 100% sure if you can buy them online. As far as I know, you can only really buy them if you meet this guy at comic conventions, which is where I got them from. I had a very long talk with him about, you know, inspiring, you know, younger, you know, creators to start working in comics, or, you know, keeping the passion alive, whether, you know, you're being beaten down by freelance work or stuff you need to do to eat. He said, his words to me were like, look, these comics, I just did these for myself. I don't really care if I sell any of them, but if I do, that's even better. But I mean, you can really tell that this guy had a lot of fun doing these, because there's all sorts of insane things. Like towards the end of one of the issues, this giant robot they've been fighting all of a sudden gains sentience and says, I wish to form an amazing new era between robots and humans of peaceful interaction. And then the woman comes in from the next room and destroys the robot because she still thinks it's evil. And they're just screaming at her. It's like, what have you done? She's like, oh, well, I didn't know. No, screw this. But there's lots of, like I said, lots of little tie backs to old comics. If you are a really big fan of comics and you've read a lot of the old DC stuff and a lot of the old Marvel stuff, you will get a lot of references in these. If not, they're still just weird and wacky and a lot of fun. In fact, they feel almost like something that you could have found in the old Mad magazines. Yes.
Yeah, we need the indie comics for this, because although the big makers have encouraged some good experiments over the years, ultimately their very success turns them into big businesses with inertia, and the indie people are free of it.
Right. I mean, the only place you can find some really truly bizarre stuff is if you go back to the 90s and you find a lot of the DC comics from the 90s. There's some really weird stuff that they were doing back in the 90s. but other than that, yeah, comics like comics going on nowadays, they're very caught up in doing these large, these large cosmic events. Right now, I believe Marvel is doing what is it? There's a yes, the Infinity. It's just called Infinity, which is more Thanos raging through the galaxy. He's alive again. I'm not sure how. Which involves the Inhumans and Black Bolt as part of it. There's a tie-in that they're doing, which is called Inhumanity.
Triton has a big chance against Thanos. It's definitely a Bambi and Godzilla type scenario. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there is a great scene of Black Bolt, unleashing his vocal powers upon Thanos, and it essentially does nothing. I mean, it's still pretty fantastic to read, and it truly is like a force of nature being unleashed. But Thanos, in the end, is merely only bruised a bit by it and punches Black Bolt into the ground.
Well, now, the vocal powers they should have invoked were those of Ben Grimm singing his version of Red Dark Array.
Oh, God.
It's so cringeworthy that Thanos just was brought to another alternative reality to get away from it.
You know what? You're probably right.
Yeah.
In that note, yeah, there's all sorts. Oh, actually, there's something which I'll include. It's a perfect way to end off the episode. There's something I'll link to. It is something I found posted on the website Tumblr. I'll also link to that that scene of Black Bolt, but it's the Impossible Man. If any of you have read the original Fantastic Four issues, he is he's essentially like a cartoon character. He's some sort of cosmic being with the power of he can do almost anything he wants, but he's incredibly jokey.
He's an annoying, irritating idiot.
Yes. Yes, and he disappeared for quite a while, and he's essentially only there for comic relief. But it was a comic that was done to kind of I don't like appease the fans, or just kind of as commentary. This comic I'm talking about was done as a commentary on It was done as a commentary on the state of comics, that everything is so dark and gritty and crazy shit is happening, and
gods are being butchered.
So he comes back and to the Fantastic Four, and he talks to Johnny Storm. He's like, where is everyone? And this is taking place right around the Civil War, Johnny tells him, like, oh, well Reed and Sue are gonna get divorced, and then Ben is over in France because he doesn't want to be caught up in the politics, and I got beat over the head by people in some sort of bar in New York City. And he's like, what? And he goes around to all these different areas and just becomes increasingly more and more disgusted by the state that the Marvel Universe is in. Everything is broken and dismantled, and nothing is happy and all hope is lost. So then he decides to pop over to our universe and goes to the Marvel studios and demands to talk to Stan Lee. And of course he gets bumped around and through the offices and is told, oh, well, Stan Lee isn't here. He's over in Hollywood. So he goes over there and he eventually does talk to Stan Lee. And he's like, the Marvel universe is a mess. Have you seen this place? Everything is horrible. And Stan Lee goes, yeah, I love it. Change is great. And it becomes this whole thing about Stan Lee telling him, essentially telling the readers that, like, don't get too bent out of shape about everything. Because, if I hadn't, made all the decisions I made when I was still writing the comics, we wouldn't have a lot of, what became the classic, hallmarks of the comics. And he cites a fact that when he originally changed the lineup for the Avengers, there was a massive, there was a massive blowback from the fans who were reading back then, and it's essentially, it's essentially basically kind of an entertaining and a polite way of telling the fans, like, look, guys, they're comics. We're going to change things. Things have to change to get more interesting. So just calm down. I think that's a good attitude to have for comics. Like, yes,
right. It is, and it's also true that Marvel always benefited by some of the negative criticism and positive, the thumbs up and the thumbs down they got from the readers. I think that helped shape those decisions as they flowed through time, and there really has to be a dance between the creators and the readers. And the negativity of the readers sometimes can be good feedback. Sometimes you just have to say, hey, sorry guys, we're moving on this way. But sometimes it needs to be heard. At least, why are they pissed off? Why are they concerned? You know, maybe, you know, that Joe Shablotnik in Brooklyn may not actually be calling the future history of the Marvel Universe, but he may have his irritation may be relevant.
Indeed, indeed. I mean, for that reason exactly, the famous The Death of Superman comic was supposed to be a much more definitive end. But there was a major backlash by the fans, and of course now that's gone into a Superman being pseudo immortal as well as being Superman. But that is a talk for another episode.
Indeed, it is.
Yes. So in closing, I hope you enjoyed our talk about Kirby and Thor and the old and the new and all sorts of stuff. Next week, I know not what we shall speak of, but I do know, I will give you a slight tease, I will be reviewing one of the newer Mark Miller books, Super Crooks, which is a fun heist-style comic, and The Star Wars. Not just Star Wars, The Star Wars, which is being produced by Dark Horse and is based on the original screenplay that George Lucas wrote for The Star Wars.
Ah, intriguing. I've always enjoyed the, was it Jack Williams? Do I have that artist right? He did a newspaper strip in the 80s for Star Wars. The Star Wars had been comics. And
oh, yes.
And very well done. I'm not getting the name right. Forgive me. That is not the correct name. But
Right.
Williamson, well, yes. I think. Williamson, yeah.
Yes. Well, in fact, there are several other Star Wars-based comics I would like to mention next episode. So, yes. Keep the hope alive, dear fans. Don't get too bent out of shape about what they're doing in the Marvel movies. Just know that these lovely creators, they work hard to bring us these fantastic stories of gods and aliens and adventurers from across the galaxy. And
plus, they're all unbelievably cute and sexy, aren't they? Oh,
indeed, yes. I wish to not elaborate too much on that, but yes, as a final parting note, support the indie artists, support the comic industry. The best place to do that, of course, is comic book shops, and my favorite, which is comixology.com, where you're still paying for the comics, you get digital comics, you can read through the website or on your
World's Only Boy is only $2 on Comixology.
Indeed. You
costs
can get
costs more than that to pick your nose.
Yes, get a comic jammed in your brain as opposed to a marble up your nose,
or a peanut.
Oh, indeed. So yes, look forward to some Star Wars related talk next week. I am, of course, the bent one.
I am the odd man.
Yes, and in the meantime, go read some comics.
Fantastic cast is
Cynthia Adler,
Bob Maxwell,
Bill Murray,
Jim Pappas,
Gary Gerheiden.
Narrated by Smilin' Stan Lee.
Excuse that. That's just S.H.I.E.L.D. calling. I'll take the call later.
Indeed.
Whatever
yes,
it is, it can wait.
God damn it. Consulting hours are from 5 to 6. Not in the morning?
I keep telling them, and they're like, yeah, but Dr. Doom, this, and that. I mean, look, I know.